Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Finally, passage of the CHIPS Act. It's the first step, but not the last word. So says the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Today on the show, the Government Affairs Director for the AFL-CIO and how two cities on the Great Lakes could help restore the Navy's submarine fleet. Welcome to the Thursday, July 28th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today, this being the last Thursday of the month. That normally goes to Mr. Bill Samuel. Bill is the Government Affairs Director for the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org, for complete updates. He's been busy, 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 and I always like to start off the show with some good news, and we finally got the good news yesterday. Passage of the CHIPS Act, formerly the COMPETES Act, and this is the legislation that will provide at least $52 billion to jumpstart semiconductor chips, the making of those chips in the United States of America. And as you probably know by now, if you're a longtime listener of this show, there is a facility in Central Ohio that has been delayed because Congress took so long to get their act together. I'm talking about the Intel facility in Central Ohio, which will create 7,000 construction jobs, and when it's completed, 3,000 people inside making those chips. And it is a great thing for America because these factories were offshore, many of them in China, and because of what the U.S. government is doing to incentivize companies to relocate, we're going to see more jobs happening. Certainly good news. I have a news release I'm going to read shortly from Scott Paul. Scott is one of our sponsors on the show on behalf of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. And he issued a statement yesterday saying semiconductor investment must be the first step, but not the last word. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Build Back Better. He seemed to be making some progress with Joe Manchin on a couple of things. Bill's going to unravel that. The NLRB funding crisis. Well, as you know, there's a lot of union organizing. In fact, we have some figures on that. Union representation petitions filed at the labor board have increased 58% during the first 9 months of fiscal year 2022. Fiscal year 22 started last October, October 1, and ended on June 30th. That being said, the NLRB has got a work overload. They have received the same appropriation, we're talking $274.2 million for nine consecutive years. Now, adjusting for inflation, that budget has actually decreased 25% since 2010. And staffing levels at the agency have dropped 39%. Jennifer Abruzzo is the general counsel for the labor board, and she said, the NLRB is processing the most cases it has seen in years, with the lowest staffing levels in the past six decades. Our dedicated staff, especially in our 48 field offices, are handling unsustainable caseloads. The agency urgently needs more resources to process petitions and conduct elections, investigate unfair labor practice charges, you know there's many of those, and obtain full remedies for workers whose labor rights have been violated. That comment from Jennifer Abruzzo, the general counsel, kind of like the top cop at the NLRB. So we'll see if Congress is going to move the needle on that. We'll also take a look at the status of some nominations and administrative appointments. There's still some some levels of government that are not fully staffed since Biden took office. Why? I mean, look how long he's been in office. Year and a half. But some conservatives don't like his picks, so they're delaying just about everything. Captain Ed Bartlett will be joining us later in the show. And this is going to be interesting because this is a guy. He's based in Broadview Heights, Ohio, and he heads the Bartlett Maritime Corporation. And he has come together. We've talked about this in various shows, especially with the Metal Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. Jimmy Hart's been on the show a couple of times talking about the possibility of having a dry dock in Lorain, Ohio, and a warehouse facility in Lordstown, Ohio. And the whole idea here is to fix and build submarines. Now, why are we doing this? Well, there's very good reason. Captain Bartlett points out that U.S. naval shipyards range from 124 to 255 years of age. Can you believe that? So the average age of a shipyard is 183 years. The GAO, that's the General Accounting Office, reported that average equipment age at naval shipyards ranges from 0.8 years past average service life to 15.3 years past average service life. Let me boil that down a little bit. We have submarines and ships dating back to Pearl Harbor days. Okay? You get the gist of what I'm talking about? Right now, and they've got some reports going from 2015 to 2019, 6,296 submarines and 1,128 aircraft carriers, their operational days were lost. You know why? Maintenance delays. Maintenance delays. So what the Bartlett Maritime Corporation is trying to do, and this is a public-private partnership, which will, among other things, reduce the cost of capital for urgently required new facilities, and they would focus on repairing the ships that are repairable right now. We're way behind. We're way behind on this whole situation. It's kind of scary. Typically, these kind of things are done on the East Coast or the West Coast, and right now, we're dealing with the supply chain. I mean, there's a lot of issues that are clouding this whole discussion. And Captain Bartlett is dealing with the federal government, so this is taking a lot of time, especially the U.S. Navy. And apparently they had a meeting just a couple of weeks ago, so he's going to give us an update. The status of the submarine force, why this matters, and why the Bartlett Maritime Corporation sought out and entered into a partnership with the Metal Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. This will be all union jobs. We're talking about 5,000 union jobs at least in Lorain, Ohio. So this will be interesting when we join with Captain Ed Bartlett later in the show. All right, more on the semiconductor chips. The Senate on Wednesday voted 64 to 33 to pass legislation to invest $52 billion in semiconductor manufacturing, along with tens of billions of dollars in funding for research and development. Now, the work is not complete, however, as the bill passed by the Senate failed to include key trade enforcement provisions to help U.S. workers and manufacturers take on the predatory trade actions of China and other nations. You knew it wasn't going to be perfect. And this is all coming from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott Paul is the executive director many times on America's Workforce. This is what he said yesterday. For decades, the United States failed to nurture its own industrial capabilities. Critical production went overseas, leading to the loss of both middle-class jobs and the knowledge needed for advanced manufacturing. Our economic and national security weakened as a result. Well, that is why it is so encouraging that senators from both sides of the aisle came together to invest in semiconductor manufacturing. Semiconductors were invented in the United States. Let's remember that. And they should be made here, too. And as we have seen over the past year, those little chips are needed to make a whole lot of things. This must be the first step rather than the last word, says Scott. Other key industries also face many of the same challenges as the semiconductor industry and are equally as important. The United States needs to do far more to bring critical production back to our shores and rebuild our industrial base. Scott goes on to say, and I'll caution that all of these investments will be for naught if the United States does not also act to counter China's predatory trade practices. American workers and manufacturers need 21st century trade tools to take on the 21st tactics deployed by the Chinese Communist Party and other bad actors. Legislation like the Leveling the Playing Field Act 2.0 is a good place to start. That measure has bipartisan support and already has been passed by the House. The Senate must find a path of passage as soon as possible. If Congress fails to follow up strategic investments with enhanced trade enforcement measures, I fear all the money that we are investing today will leak away tomorrow without making an impact. Now, Scott Paul wrote to the congressional leadership, this was 2 days ago on Tuesday, to express appreciation that Congress is making public investments in America's industrial sector while encouraging additional efforts to level the playing field for American manufacturing and its workers. You can find more on what he says and what he's been doing. He has been vigilant on this issue for months now. AmericanManufacturing.org is the website. So, like just about anything, Congress got there, but they need to do more. You know what I say? One step at a time. One step at a time. I'm sure Bill Samuel will have that same opinion, and he'll be coming up next right here on America's Workforce.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans, and we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers, and we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
To Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, always connecting people with employment, good wages, good benefits, ulagency.org. All right, let's go to Washington, D.C., the nation's capital right now, and standing by is Mr. Bill Samuel, longtime contributor to America's Workforce. He serves as Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. And I'll tell you, we had a really, really busy week. Bill Samuel, you need a vacation after this
week. I do.
What do you think?
A lot happened in a very short amount of time this week in Washington.
Let's start off with the CHIPS Act here, and I just read a statement from Scott Paul. You know Scott from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. He said, hey, this is a good step, but it's not the last step. And unfortunately, and I know how things go in Washington, you got to take kind of like baby steps. You got to eventually get to what you want. And apparently, there's an issue here dealing with China, leveling the playing field. They didn't incorporate that. So why don't you explain what happened and what didn't happen? Go ahead.
Right. Well, it's a long and torturous path that this bill took. It began as something called the Endless Frontier Bill. This is almost 2 years ago. Chuck Schumer and Todd Young, a Republican, got together and said, we need to beef up American manufacturing, our competitiveness with China. We need to do more research, and we need to innovate more because China was sort of eating our lunch. That was the fear. So that was the initial idea, and a lot of the money went to the National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, places like that. It then became, the next version of it was called the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, USICA. That's actually what the Senate passed, and they added to the innovation provisions money for the revitalization of the semiconductor industry, the so-called CHIPS Act, about $50 billion. So the total was somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 billion altogether. So money for research and development and then money to revitalize the manufacturing of the semiconductor industry, which, by the way, your listeners probably know are critical to automobiles, farm equipment, and other manufactured goods, these chips. And there are lots of cars that have been produced in Detroit that are sitting in lots because they don't have the computer chips. They're mostly now made overseas in Asia, and we've let our own domestic manufacturing capability wither so that there's a real shortage of chips. So the Senate passed USICA, and then the House passed a different version of that bill called the COMPETES Act. It included some very strong trade language. So in addition to trying to out-compete China, it also included provisions that required them to engage in fair trade so they weren't dumping products in the U.S. and putting American workers on unemployment lines because of unfair competition. So then a conference committee started to meet, I guess, 4 or 5 months ago on the COMPETES and USICA bills. And then, sort of out of the blue, the Republicans said, we will only support on the Senate floor the CHIPS bill. So they would agree to the $50 billion for the semiconductor provisions for the chip manufacturing, but nothing else. And then at the very last minute, they added back much of the innovation section, the innovation technology development, so research money for the National Science Foundation. So it's back to about a little under $250 billion. Again, the core of it is the CHIPS Act. They're now calling it CHIPS Plus. That's what finally passed the Senate yesterday. It will undoubtedly pass the House today or tomorrow and be signed by the president. It's actually a strong bill, as Scott Paul said. These are necessary investments in U.S. manufacturing. It doesn't do very much on trade, which we still that's on our to-do list. We're always encouraging the administration to get tough on China. That used to be something that Republicans were for as well, but they for some reason they walked away from it at the last minute. So that's the CHIPS Plus Act, and again, overall a plus for American workers, for manufacturing, but there's more to do on the trade front. And then one other thing they left out, which the House had added when they took up the bill initially, was the renewal of the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act, which provides training and assistance to workers who lose their jobs because of unfair trade. That was dropped as well. Republicans insisted that not be part of this bill. And, the problem with all this is that it takes Republican votes in the Senate. You need 10 Republicans to pass anything unless there are special procedures involved like reconciliation, which we'll talk about in a minute, which you can pass with just 50. So to get 10 Republicans, you have to compromise. And they insisted on dropping the good trade language and dropping trade adjustment assistance. They went along with most of the rest of the bill, and that's what will become law.
All right, let's stop right there for a little bit.
It's a long explanation. I apologize.
No, it's good. It's good. No, you did a good job on that. I'm a little confused on the trade situation, especially with the conservatives, because they have pretty much embraced that issue in the last couple of years. Even Trump did. And they've been attacking China because of the dumping that's been going on and the loss of jobs here. So what happened? Why aren't they getting tough on trade?
It is really kind of hard to explain, because you're right about that. There's a segment of the Republican Party that was sort of activated by Trump, very critical of China. But I think overall the Republican Party is still kind of in the grips of the corporate global corporation belief that multinationals, basically are good for America, strengthening the rights and competitiveness of multinational companies. And they're, whether they invest in China or Mexico or wherever, they're mostly U.S. corporations that are doing this. And so there's a pretty big segment of the Republican Party that still sort of protects them and doesn't want to go after individual companies or countries. And so that McConnell just said, you're not going to get 10 Republicans if you include that language. So they dropped the China language and the trade language, basically under pressure from corporate interests. And that still pretty much dominate the Republican Party.
All right, let's move on to Build Back Better. Now, this is a surprise here. Joe Manchin, as we all know, has been holding up things with Build Back Better. He said originally that it was too much. They whittled it down. It was still too much. He said he was going to support it. Then all of a sudden he pulled out. What happened here in the last week or two, Bill?
Yeah, well, he's pulled out more than once. Back in December, when it looked like there'd be a deal with Manchin and the Democrats in the Senate. I think at that time they were talking about $1.5 trillion Build Back Better deal. Then throughout the winter and early spring of this year, he kind of went back and forth. He said he would, and there were rumors that he was back at the negotiating table. He might agree to some stripped down package. Remember, this started out at $6 trillion. When Bernie Sanders first introduced this bill, this budget reconciliation bill with the president, was $6 trillion. And then the next version of it was $3.5 trillion. And that's what the House passed, Build Back Better. And then it was $1.7 trillion, and that's what was being negotiated when Manchin backed away kind of suddenly around Christmas, leaving Democrats empty-handed and really steaming that they felt that they had been misled. It took quite a while for him to come back to the table. And of course, in West Virginia, for whatever reason, this didn't hurt him at all. His approval ratings were going up through this whole period. So there wasn't a lot of incentive, I think, at least politically, for him to come back to the table and agree to a big budget reconciliation bill with a lot of spending and paid for with tax increases on the wealthy and corporations. In any case, in the last couple of weeks, apparently, he got serious about it for whatever reason. We heard rumors about it, but he wouldn't confirm it. His office wouldn't confirm it. Senator Schumer's office wouldn't confirm it. In fact, I was hearing different things about what might be included. At one point, he would not agree to any energy provisions. He wouldn't agree to tax increases. They were focused on health care issues, giving Medicare the power to negotiate over prescription drug prices, which were for, and continuing some Affordable Care Act premium supports, which were passed in Congress during the height of the COVID pandemic, to make health care available to more people. About 10 million Americans got reduced premiums as a result. And so we were expecting what would come out was health care and maybe a little bit of and the tax savings from Medicare. And that was about it. That's what we were expecting. And then yesterday, what was announced was sort of surprised everybody. Climate was back on the table. He agreed to about almost $400 billion in climate-related provisions. And these are, we say climate, because it will result in cleaner energy. But it's a lot of money for industry to convert, to transition to renewable sources and cleaner fossil fuel energy sources. So it's good for us. It's good for labor primarily. You know, it's going to keep people at work and put people to work in new industries. And there are protections for Buy America involved and tax credits for Dave that include Davis Bacon and registered apprenticeships, both for the production of energy and the manufactured products that go into energy, like windmills and solar panels. So all that's in there, about $300+ billion, and the health care provisions I talked about earlier, prescription drug authority for Medicare to negotiate down prices on prescription drugs, caps on inflation, increases in drugs. Pharma is furious about this, by the way. They're running ads nonstop. And then finally, he did agree to some tax increases, a 15% minimum tax on corporations, closing the so-called the loophole that allows Wall Street hedge funds to, you know, pay lower taxes than their, you know, staff, their secretaries pay on their income, the so-called carried interest loophole. So it's a pretty big package. It's all told close to $800 billion. Shocked everybody, and it will not get a single Republican vote, but it won't need it because it's coming up under the budget reconciliation procedures, which allow you to allow the Senate to pass a vote with just 51, a simple majority. The only senator we don't know about at this point is Kyrsten Sinema, who, as you know, has been sort of a fly in the ointment over the last year or two. We think she'll have to go along with this. I can't imagine her holding it up, but stranger things have happened. So this could be on the Senate floor next week.
And again, just to be clear, the PRO Act provisions, they were completely taken out?
Well, we had hoped, and we had, in the House when they passed this last year, they did include some, you know, sort of miscellaneous provisions not related to energy or health care. One of them was from the PRO Act. It was an important one. It would levy fines on companies that violate the National Labor Relations Act, up to $50,000 per violation. So Amazon, Starbucks, and, you know, smaller companies for whom this would make a difference, would have to pay penalties if the NLRB found that they were in violation of the right to form unions, bargain. You know, it would be a huge change for us because, as you know, there are no financial penalties at all for violating the National Labor Relations Act. You get a slap on the wrist, and that's why companies continue to do it. That was dropped. We're told because, among others, maybe Manchin wouldn't agree to it. I'm not sure why that is. He's a supporter of the PRO Act. He's a co-sponsor.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to get to the bottom of that in the next 48 hours.
That doesn't make any sense.
We're going to want to come back to that. So as with the CHIPS bill, you know, there are a lot of positives. There are some disappointments. Overall, you know, I think we'll end up supporting this bill because of the health care and climate and energy provisions and tax increases on the wealthy. That moves the country forward. We've still got work to do on labor law reform, and that's where we are as of late July 2022.
Like I said, very, very busy week, and there's more. We got to take a quick break here. Bill Samuel joining us on our live line. Bill is the Government Affairs Director for the AFL-CIO, AFLCIO.org, their website. Later in the show, we're going to check in with Captain Ed Bartlett and talk about the Bartlett Maritime Plan. Really interesting on revitalizing our naval submarines. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective Democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on at least six platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so keep them coming. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director for the AFL-CIO. As I indicated, lots going on. We got the passage of the CHIPS Act, CHIPS Plus. We're also moving forward with Build Better. Now we got to fund the NLRB, and it's grossly underfunded, and they are busier than ever. A lot of union organizing going on, and when you factor in inflation, I mean, they're really, really way down. Their budget hasn't changed for at least 12 years. So you think this is going to happen, Bill? Are we going to get more money to the NLRB? What's your thoughts?
Well, I hope so. I mean, they'll, you know, they will at least get the amount of funding that they've been getting. But it's been the Republicans have been blocking increases for almost a decade. When President Obama was in office, he began to put more money into the NLRB and OSHA and the Wage and Hour Administration, other labor protection agencies. But as soon as the Republicans took over, and I guess it was 2011, after that horrible midterm election, Republicans at that point just insisted on keeping the NLRB in handcuffs, and it's gone for almost 10 years now. This year, the House Democrats have put quite a bit more money in for the NLRB, and the reason is clear. There's a big increase, really an explosion in organizing. This is all overseen by the National Labor Relations Board. And from 2022 to 2021, we're looking at a 57% increase in election petitions filed with the NLRB. We're looking at an increase of about 15% in unfair labor practices filed by the NLRB to try to go to bat for workers who are in organizing campaigns and bargaining, who are who are in situations where the employer is violating the law for one reason or another. So the NLRB, to get the job done, to be an enforcement agency with teeth, needs more money. So we've advocated a pretty big increase this year. The administration supported it. The House has gone along with it. I'm not sure where the Senate will be. The Senate Democrats will undoubtedly go along with the increase, at least $325 billion. I think right now they're funded at about $280. Something like that. This is not a lot of money by Washington standards. We're talking millions, not billions. And we're talking $280 million versus what the House Democrats think is necessary, at least $325 million. So that's it's a hefty increase. But again, they've gotten no increases for 10 years. By the way, if you look at inflation over those 10 years, measured against that, they're 20% behind where they were in 2011. So that's the impact of inflation and not getting any increases in real dollars. So we're going to be fighting for this until the end of the fiscal year when they have to pass a new budget for federal government, September 30. I don't know whether Republicans will go to the mat on this. They have in the past said no, they will not agree to appropriation bills overall if they increase money for the National Labor Relations Board because they are totally in the back pocket of business, and those businesses particularly that are fighting organizing campaigns. We'll have to see, but I think Democrats are ready for the fight. I know President Biden is, and hopefully we're going to get an increase for the board. They are desperately in need of it. There's really it's almost a crisis. We've talked to Senator Schumer about it, and he is committed to it. So we'll just have to see how much we can wring out of this process before the end of the year.
It's really sad to know that there's elected officials in this country that that really don't care about labor rights. Employer violations, safety. You touched on OSHA. They would like these divisions in our government to just go away.
You know, when the Republicans are in charge, the agencies, you know, exist, but they basically turn out the lights at OSHA, at the NLRB, at Wage and Hour Division. Democrats come in, they try to revitalize it. You know, you've got a career staff that you've got to turn everything around. You got to bring new political leadership in. It takes a little bit of time, and you got to make sure you've got the support in Congress. Particularly on the appropriations front. It's a little bit of a pendulum. You know, Democrats are in charge. They tend to get more. OSHA has gotten a little more money in wage and hour over the years. They haven't been sat on like the National Labor Relations Board. You know, it's what you said. Republicans will go to great lengths to protect business from being organized. And they're not bashful about it.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, they're very vocal about it. Let's switch over to prevailing wage. I talked about this the other day, and I thank you for sending me the list of Republicans who voted on the side of organized labor on the building trades. That there was a vote. This was last week, I believe. Yeah. 165-264. 165 of those, all Republican members of the Congress, elected officials that decided that we don't need prevailing wages. We don't need Davis Bacon in the United States of America. And this is a law that goes back to 1931. It's been very effective. It's worked. It had Republican support when it started, but they don't want to be part of that. Why does this always come up? Can you explain that part to me, Bill?
Well, almost every year, the non-union contractors, the Associated Building Contractors, ABC, demands that Republicans hold a vote to repeal Davis-Bacon. In this case, it was on an appropriation bill providing funds for the Department of Transportation and HUD and a few other agencies where, because it's federal funding, Davis-Bacon applies. You've got to pay locally prevailing wages, which is not always the union wage, but in many cases is. And it protects state labor standards from a race to the bottom, and from decreasing, you know, every year as non-union contractors, fly-by-night operators try to come in and get these government contracts. So Davis-Bacon prevents that from happening. So they get a vote about every year. And I have to say, this is one area where a segment of the Republican Party, in this case about, I think, 41 Republicans, voted to uphold Davis-Bacon as part of this bill. And that's generally where the building trades unions are in terms of support from the Republican Party. It's in the 40s. That's pretty much, you know, when they're, I think right now there's 200 and how many Republicans are there in Congress? 205 or something. You lose 165, but you get about 40. And that's good news for the labor movement. You know, we count on Republicans. In that case, we could have done it with just Democrats. You know, there are enough Democrats in the House to protect Davis-Bacon. Now, the Senate's a different story, but they tend to get a handful of Republicans to support them in the Senate as well. I think Davis-Bacon is safe for another year. As we said earlier, it's part of this energy package that's in the budget reconciliation bill. This new funding that goes for the transition to greener energy comes with Davis-Bacon. So all the construction of equipment and plants and energy facilities will come with Davis-Bacon protection. So it's very important to the labor movement that we hold on to that.
The conservatives, and I have to say this, they do a good job of just discrediting so many things, including Davis-Bacon, saying that it leads to higher costs for construction. And Bill, you know this. There's been study after study. In fact, Don Norcross, who comes from the IBEW, he's a Democrat out of New Jersey, pointed out, this is, you know, we've looked at this for years, and Davis Bacon increases productivity, raises wages, helps local contractors, promotes high-quality apprenticeship programs. What's wrong with that? You know,
yeah. But the only thing that is really protected that Republicans don't want to talk about are higher wages. The projects themselves don't cost more, except to the extent you're getting a better quality,
right?
Product, a bridge that's not going to collapse or a parking lot that's not going to fall over. Which, you know, when you use shoddy construction, sure you can save money, but you're going to potentially injure workers and just, you know, ordinary Americans walking by when these things collapse. And so Davis Bacon helps you get professional, well-trained construction companies and workers. And sure, wages are a little higher, but that's you're paying for quality. And we do that in all aspects of life. You can always cut corners and pay less, but most people understand that that's not the end goal here, is just to pay less for whether it's a product or a construction. And so Davis Bacon is the law that requires that we pay. And by the way, you don't want a race to the bottom. You know, we can always pay less for something, but that's not the goal here. The goal is to keep Americans at work and to be producing high quality goods and projects.
Get it done right the first time. I have to laugh because the list you sent me, one of the Republicans' names is Bacon.
Yeah, that's right, from Nebraska.
He probably Bacon thought he was voting for himself, you know?
Right, bringing home the bacon and Davis Bacon, that's right.
Oh, my God. All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director for the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org is a website. You take care. Great segments today. Filled us in with a lot of information. You keep it going. We'll talk to you next month, okay?
Thanks a lot. Bye.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break right now. When we come back, we're going to check in with Captain Ed Bartlett of the Bartlett Maritime Corporation. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Ironworkers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 ironworkers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union ironworkers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our ironworkers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. Make sure you get the word union in there. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Let's go to line number two. Joining us from Broadview Heights, Ohio, that's where they're headquartered, it's the Bartlett Maritime Corporation. BartlettMaritime.com is the website. Captain Ed Bartlett joining us. And, you know, when it comes to our Navy, there's submarines that need to be built. There's submarines that need to be repaired. And it seems, apparently, according to the stats that Captain Bartlett is going to lay on us, there's a lot that needs to be done. We're way behind the eight ball here. Captain Bartlett, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Why don't you Give us a little background on yourself. You were a captain in the Navy, and now you have the Bartlett Maritime Corporation, which I understand is a public-private partnership. And I know you put a lot of thought into this. You met with a lot of people, a lot of union folks. You had that big rally in Lorain, Ohio, back in May. And tell me about your background and what you're trying to do here, because it's quite fascinating. Go ahead.
Actually, I'm not actually a former captain in the Navy. I'm a captain in the Merchant Marine. So slightly different, same thing, but slightly different. The my background is I'm a submariner from the Cold War. I sailed on three attack submarines during the Cold War. One of them was brand new. I was in the construction process with it, the first crew. One of them was well used and toward the latter half of its life. And it was that ship, the USS Gato, which actually influenced me the most in wanting to start this business and address this issue. After I left the Navy, I went to work for General Dynamics at their shipyard in Groton, Connecticut, Electric Boat, where I worked briefly in the shipyard in construction engineering, and then went into submarine design, worked on the design of the Seawolf class submarine, and then I led the initial design of the Virginia class submarine, the ship that's currently being built, the attack submarine is currently built by the Navy. After that, I joined Eaton Corporation, headquartered in Cleveland, and rescued a failed business of theirs in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, actually sold that for them to DRS Technologies and created, through acquisitions, a unit called DRS Power Systems, which is the largest supplier of power and propulsion equipment for U.S. Navy ships today. So after I did all that, I decided to go be an entrepreneur. And starting in 2018, this issue with submarine maintenance came to my attention and frankly just angered me. And I decided that if no one else was going to address it, then I would. And so that's basically my background on how I got started on this project.
And I know it has not been easy trying to deal with the federal government, especially the U.S. Navy on this. You've had a number of meetings. I mentioned the rally, which was well attended. I understand that a couple of weeks ago, you got a little bit closer to the finish line. Can you tell us where we are with this project? And also, my understanding, we're talking 5,000 jobs that could be created in Lorain and then more in Lordstown, Ohio. Is that still pretty much in the plan here?
Right. Our plan is for the Lordstown site. There are two basic problems. The entire submarine industrial base is behind the eight ball. On the construction side, we've been ordering two new attack submarines per year since 2011, starting that year. And the sad truth is, and part of it's COVID, but part of it is just lack of capacity, we're five submarines behind on delivery. The Navy should have received five more submarines since 2011 than it has. And now on top of that, we have to build the Columbia class to replace the strategic missile submarines, the Ohio class, which are aged out. They're 42 years old, which is ancient for a submarine. So all of a sudden, the demand on construction went up by about a factor of five compared to where it was in the first decade of the century. On the other side of the street, we've got 50 attack submarines, and half of them, a full half of them, are not available for operation. Normally, about 20% of them are in scheduled maintenance, but that would have been about 10. So there are 25 not available right now. That means 15 ships are parked that should be available, and they're not ready to go because the lack of maintenance capacity. So our approach is on the Lordstown site, we intend to do component repair to accelerate the completion of the overhaul in the naval shipyards. So parts get taken off the ships during the overhauls, and they have to be inspected, repaired, rebuilt, refurbished. And we're going to do that for all the naval shipyards in Lordstown. On the other side, because of this increased demand in shipbuilding at the Lorain site, we intend to build modules, submodules, 300-ton pieces of submarine. It won't be the hulls. It'll be the parts inside. The way a submarine is built today, the hull is built separately, and then the internal pieces come in modules or packages that are slid in from the end, and then the hull's put together to close up the ship. So we'll be building some of the modules that slide into the ships in Lorraine. And we're looking at several thousand jobs between the two locations, up to 5,000 jobs. That's our objective, and that's what's needed in order to support the submarine force and expand the industrial base to meet demand.
Captain Bartlett, what's baffling to me, I'm sure it's baffling to you, is we're so far behind. I mean, this is a defense issue here. I mean, if something should happen, you know how dangerous the world is today. We need those submarines.
More dangerous than ever.
Yes, very dangerous. Why is this taking so long? I guess that's the question. I mean, come on, this should have been done years ago.
Well, I started it in November of 2018. And it's taken me this long to get it done. This is a complex issue. And, you know, let's face it, the government is a bit of a bureaucracy. And, you know, it's hard, particularly our financing approach is very novel. Our plan is a public-private partnership, which is facilitated by federal law that was passed in 1989. When the law was passed, the congressional report that accompanied it stated that it was there to provide for urgently required facilities and would reduce the cost of their acquisition. It's never been used yet. It's available now. And so part of our issue has been convincing everyone in Washington that this congressionally authorized action is available and should be used. So matching that up with a State of Ohio program issue bonds, all of a sudden what we've done, the big thing that we've done here is we've taken a multi-billion dollar project potentially and made it really affordable in the currently constrained budget environment for the U.S. Navy. So that's really the secret sauce. We've made something very difficult to attain affordable.
And it's still difficult to achieve. That's the crazy part about this scenario.
Nothing's easy.
Nothing's easy. I get that. Now, I do like the fact that you got this partnership with the Metal Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. So we're talking all union jobs then, right?
The construction jobs will all be union jobs, and when we start hiring our skilled trades employees, the partnership we've established with Metal Trades Council is that we'll be open and welcoming to them to come in and organize our people. Obviously, both sides have to follow the National Labor Relations Act, all the rules, but we're completely open to them coming in and organizing our personnel. We think that the union workforce is an advantage for a company like this. And I've worked in many union shops and have great relationship with all the unions. And we welcome them to our partnership, and we think it's a great plus for our team.
Well, no argument there. I salute you for going in that direction. And I know Jimmy Hart, he's been on the show a couple of times. He's a fireball, and he wants this to happen like tomorrow. Speaking of which, what's the next move? What's on your agenda here to make this happen?
Well, speaking of tomorrow, I'm going to the Pentagon, and then on Monday, a number of our executive team members are going to go visit the senior levels of the Navy again. You know, nothing has been reduced to pen and ink yet, but, you know, the increasing occurrence of meetings at these high levels obviously signals that there's a lot of interest and that I feel like we're breaking through, and we're very close to getting this started.
Okay, when you say we're close to getting this started, and I know you're probably skeptical about throwing a date out there because hopefully this was going to happen a while ago, and it hasn't. We know it's difficult, but you think we might see something by the end of this year? What's your gut telling you?
I'm hoping to see something in the next 2 weeks. How's that?
I like that. I like that.
That's what I'm working for.
Okay. Well, we'll check in with you from time to time. We like the fact that these are all union jobs, thousands of union jobs in areas that need those jobs. I mean, it's so important. We've seen a loss of jobs, especially in Lordstown in Lorraine, Ohio, and it'll be great for this to happen. BartlettMaritime.com is a website. You want to get some more information, BartlettMaritime.com. Captain, thank you so much for joining us. Keep in touch, please, okay?
It's been my pleasure. Have a great day.
All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, we're going to talk to judges, the presidents of the Social Security Administration and the immigration judges. Until then, all of you, have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.